From Community Public Radio, this is the CPR News. From New York, I'm Don DeBar. That was the sound as thousands of people gathered Friday in Syntagma Square in Athens to support the government's call for a no vote in the upcoming referendum Sunday on whether to accept the bailout conditions laid out by the country's institutional creditors. Among those to address the crowd was the country's prime minister, Alexis Tsipras. Earlier Friday, Tsipras said that the only way to make the country's debt load sustainable would be to cut it by 30% and grant the country a 20-year extension on its payment schedule. That statement came after the IMF said Thursday that Greece would need 10 billion euros over the next few months and an additional 50 billion over the next 3 years just to pay the country's arrears, and that before making any repayments, Greece would need a 20-year extension on its payment schedule, moving the last payment out to at least 2055. Tsipras complained that the report published Thursday was never submitted to Athens during the past 5 months of negotiations and was released only after the talks had finally failed. Also on Friday, the Council of State, the top administrative court of Greece, declared that the referendum is constitutional, allowing the balloting to be held Sunday as scheduled. The prime minister's position found strong support from the UN Human Rights Council's Special Rapporteur on Democracy and Equity, Alfred De Zayas, who said that the austerity and privatization demanded by Greece's creditors would not help the country solve its debt crisis. Daniel Johnson has more.
For Special Rapporteur Alfred De Zayas, it's very clear who's in the wrong when it comes to the Greek debt crisis. Big money, and as he believes, unaccountable institutions like the International Monetary Fund and the European Central Bank. Over the last 5 years, their demands on Greece have been disastrous, De Zayas says, and it's about time they realised more belt-tightening measures won't work. De Zayas, who's an independent expert on democracy and equity appointed by the Human Rights Council in Geneva, is highly critical of the lack of international solidarity on Greece's predicament. In short, the only option for Greek Prime Minister Alexis Tsipras is to ask the people what to do next, De Zayas says.
I don't think that Tsipras has much of a choice. Whereas we can spend billions for building warships and building nuclear missiles and weapons, etc., when it comes to help a nation, actually a friendly nation, member of the European Union, you would think that the principles of human rights and solidarity within the European Union would necessarily lead to helping this country in trouble.
Youth unemployment is currently at 60%, and the country's GDP has shrunk by a quarter. Whatever the outcome of Sunday's poll, De Zayas says that most Greeks do not want to leave the euro. But he added there was some confusion about what a no vote actually meant. Daniel Johnson, United Nations, Geneva.
Solidarity protests popped up across Europe Friday. That was the sound from Berlin late in the day. Residents of Venice, Italy, flooded the streets to support a no vote in Sunday's referendum, and solidarity events were also held in most major cities on the continent and in the UK. China on Friday urged the U.S. to abandon what it called a Cold War mentality and said it should try to avoid confrontation. The statement by Foreign Ministry spokesperson Hua Chunying came after the Pentagon's latest military report charged China with acting to add tension to the Asia-Pacific region.
We expressed our discontentment and objection to the so-called China threat theory in the Pentagon report. China has repeatedly elaborated its stance on its rightful construction in the South China Sea. The U.S. should abandon its Cold War mentality, perceive China's strategic intentions in a correct way, and adhere to the consensus achieved by leaders of both sides. The U.S. side should stop making irresponsible comments, avoid confrontation, strengthen mutual respect to push forward progress in building a new model of major power relationship. This also benefits the U.S. side.
Russia also responded to the Pentagon report's claims that its military actions undermine regional security directly and through proxy wars. The Kremlin described the report's language as confrontational, saying the accusations impair efforts to normalize relations. Moscow has pledged to note all threats to its national security and to take countermeasures. Relations between the two countries have hit their lowest point since the end of the Cold War. Iran said that significant progress has been made in its talks with the so-called P5+1 group. Press TV's team coverage of the talks begins with this report from Waqar Rizvi.
Iranian Foreign Minister Mohammad Javad Zarif says significant progress has been made in nuclear talks between Iran and the P5+1 in the Austrian capital. Zarif said the West has to decide whether it wants a deal or is seeking to put more pressure on Tehran. This comes as nuclear negotiations continue between Iran and the P5+1 for the seventh consecutive day in Vienna. The Iranian foreign minister is set to meet with his U.S. counterpart, John Kerry, later in the day. The two sides are holding talks to finalize the text of a possible final deal. The removal of sanctions against Iran and access to or inspections of Iran's military sites seem to be the major stumbling blocks. The head of the International Atomic Energy Agency says Iran and the IAEA have reached a better understanding over Tehran's nuclear energy program. Following his visit to Tehran, Yukiya Amano, however, said that more work will be needed. Iran's deputy foreign minister described Amano's visit to Tehran as a good opportunity to remove misunderstandings about possible military dimensions to Iran's nuclear program. Abbas Araghchi says Tehran is ready for cooperation with the IAEA to prove that it has had a clear record and that the anti-Iran allegations are an illusion. In 2011, the United States and its allies released documents to the IAEA that allegedly revealed there had been military dimensions to Iran's nuclear program.
With more on the visit from the IAEA, Gisu Misha Amadi filed this report from Tehran.
A previously unscheduled visit to Iran marked with a string of meetings with high-ranking Iranian officials. Head of the International Atomic Energy Agency, Yukiya Amano, is hoping to accelerate the resolution of all outstanding issues related to Iran's nuclear program, according to an IAEA statement ahead of a July 7th deadline for Iran and the P5+1 to agree a deal as talks continue in Vienna.
Amano's visit is a business trip in which he is expected to discuss two important issues that so far remain unresolved. First is the possible military dimensions, which needs to be clarified, and second is to receive Iran's alternative proposal to the proposed questioning of its nuclear scientists. So although Mr. Amano is not representing the P5+1, these meetings can be helpful.
Iran has the political will to reach a fair and balanced nuclear agreement that secures its rights as a member of the Non-Proliferation Treaty, as Secretary of Iran's Supreme National Security Council, Ali Shamkhani, told Amano. However, the sustainability of any deal, according to him, depends on the satisfaction of the involved parties.
Obviously, this is a positive sign. Mr. Amano wouldn't be here if he didn't have any solutions in mind. Let's not forget that Mr. Amano was never so adamant in resolving issues such as the possible military dimensions, which is an accusation raised by the U.S. and Israeli intelligence dating back to 2003 to 2006.
Iran's President Hassan Rouhani did not mince words in his meeting with Amano, clearly reminding the IAEA that it should not get in politics in order to perform its technical and legal duties. Rouhani said that if there's the necessary will on both sides, and if irrelevant issues are not raised, finding a solution is possible in a short time.
Whatever happens will set the benchmark for a legal procedure for all countries who wish to acquire peaceful nuclear technology.
Amano's visit comes after the IAEA has recently confirmed Tehran's commitment to what was agreed with the P5+1, and while Iran is saying that it is ready to expand its cooperation with the agency.
Now, experts are saying that while the outcome of the Thursday talks between the IAEA chief and high-ranking Iranian officials is still not known, it can at least be seen as a positive sign and an indicator of progress as negotiations continue in Vienna. Gisu Misha Ahmadi, Press TV, Tehran.
As we reported earlier in the week, the optimism in Havana over renewed diplomatic relations with the U.S., the uncertainty in Greece over its debt load, and the outright gloom in Puerto Rico as it stares bankruptcy in the face, drew an odd sort of comparison of the three countries based on their individual histories and their widely divergent political structures. For more on all of that, we spoke with Tony Solo, a reporter from south of the border, via Skype from his home in Managua, Nicaragua.
There's all kinds of news going on down here. A lot of people are focusing on the news around Cuba and the United States normalizing their relations. They're supposed to exchange ambassadors for the first time in over, 54 years,
yeah.
So on July 20th, so and that's a landmark event. That will be a landmark event.
Yep.
And other stuff going on. There's just winding up an important meeting in terms of Latin America's future integration and the path that integration is going to take. A meeting just finishing up today between the Pacific Alliance countries, Chile, Colombia, Peru, and Mexico. I was actually surprised to learn, and I suppose it's obvious when you think about it, but that, and they have a population of over 200 million people as a group.
Wow, that's right.
And they're the seventh main exporting country in the world, and they have in terms of GDP, which is a very problematic measure, but one that's commonly used, and they're the eighth biggest economy in the world.
So that if they have 200 million people, that means that's a third of Latin American Caribbean population, roughly. Then, right?
Yeah.
Wow.
Yeah. Wow. And Brazil's population. I think Brazil's population is just over 200 million.
Yeah. So that means that right. This they're as big as the rest of Latin American and Caribbean, except Brazil. Wow.
Right.
And that's the U.S. allies, these guys, right? This is Chile, Colombia, Mexico, and Peru.
And they're following a kind of neoliberal free market. No, I can't say that without wanting to add ha-ha.
Ha-ha, you're right, burp.
But, you know, and that's their model. And they're focusing, they're building themselves into a bloc that's capable of competing with Brazil, for example, with that China has to take seriously as a trade partner, that the United States has to take seriously as a trade partner.
Right.
And, you know, and that's in marked contrast to mine here in Nicaragua. People are very, very anxious about the terms of the CAFTA, Central America Free Trade Agreement that was signed back in whenever it was, 2006 now.
Right.
But it's only now, 10 years later, that key provisions of that agreement are going to come into effect.
Yeah.
And that's that people here are very anxious about the effect that those new provisions are going to have on.
Well, at least they have a government that will defend them.
Yeah, and the important thing is that one of the first things that Daniel Ortega did in January 2007 when he took office was to join ALBA, and it's ALBA that has provided a framework that is going to people can see now the wisdom of that move by Daniel Ortega. If they couldn't see it before, they must have been blind. But now even the right-wing commentators are conscious of the fact that the ALBA framework is going to give a measure of protection to Nicaraguan producers who are now going to have to compete on completely unequal terms with products from North America.
Right. Yeah.
So that's, you know, and that's that whole issue of, you know, how is Latin America to develop in the future? And that it's all kind of seamless, isn't it? So there's so many factors that are involved in it, and you were pointing out to me before we came on air the significance of the situation in Puerto Rico.
Right. Yeah, that an interesting discussion I mentioned with Dr. Gerald Horn, I was looking at doing the news on Wednesday morning. I was starting to assemble for the newscast for the afternoon, and I had on my desk the situation in Greece in some considerable depth, and I was going to do a large piece about it, so I had Varoufakis and what his update on things, and Tsipras, and some analysis that I had put together, and also the situation in Puerto Rico, and then of course that was the day that Obama gave his speech about the letters that were exchanged about opening the embassies. So I kind of tossed them up in the air in my head and realized that there was an odd symmetry there, that Puerto Rico and Greece had in common this debt problem, but Puerto Rico is constrained by its colonial status from dealing with it. It was basically going to be dictated to by whoever wields power out of the creditors. And Syriza, of course, being elected by the Greek people, so given the mandate to fight back against the 7 years of austerity and longer of neoliberal debt that they've been dealing with, and that Cuba, everybody was saying, well, you know, they were trying to hype the fact that the contact with the U.S. means that they're going to end up becoming a capitalist country, but they're spinning it like, you know, everybody's going to be rich down there and everything's coming up roses kind of thing. So I was like,
right,
you know, okay, Cuba stakes out an independent course for itself, endures 50 some odd years of Cold War and attempted invasion and almost thermonuclear devastation, and now they're coming up roses. Puerto Rico is about as close a friend as you can get to the United States, sort of like a friend that a pedophile would have, the 9-year-old friend. And
right.
And Greece, having suffered, is now starting to chart a course out for itself. And it seemed that, you know, if Puerto Rico and Greece were going to choose a model, I would say that it would be Cuba's model that would give them some hope for the future.
Yeah, and if you look at the way the other countries are going, and just to go back to the relative weight in the international or the global economy, if you like, and the other countries together have a population of about, I think it's 75 million now.
Mm-hmm.
So they themselves are not an insignificant bloc, and if you look at the composition of ALBA, it's Ecuador, Bolivia, Cuba, Venezuela, of course, and Nicaragua, and I think it's 4 or 5 Caribbean nations now, Santa Lucia, St. Vincent and the Grenadines, Dominica, Antigua and Barbuda, I think I'm missing one, but I mean, those Caribbean island nations. And these are all very vulnerable countries, so what ALBA has done is given those relatively vulnerable countries. I mean, Bolivia has always been the poorest country in South America, for example. Nicaragua has always been the poorest country in Central America. And the Caribbean island nations, of course, are wide open to being bullied by much bigger countries, giants like the United States, for example, as historically they have been. And Puerto Rico is a perfect example of that. But ALBA has given those countries that possibility of strength and unity. And I found it interesting that even a relatively right-wing government leader, I've forgotten his name, it's the Prime Minister of Barbados, but even he is talking about strength and unity at the moment in the CARICOM Nation Summit that is currently happening. I'm not sure if it winds up today or tomorrow.
Yeah.
But that theme of strength and unity is one that you can see happening in different ways. And if you, I mean, the Cuba is a wonderful example of the way allying itself with Venezuela in particular, but
right,
also with the other ALBA countries,
right,
has enabled it to pretty much, I'm convinced that its membership of ALBA is what has forced the United States' hand, finally,
yeah,
after all this time.
Yeah, you know, it's interesting. To go back, first of all, to the Pacific Alliance, which is, you know, more or less with the, you know, Chile has a different president somewhat, but, you know, these are like some of the closest allies of the United States in that region, and yet each of those countries, more or less, I think even including Mexico, are forced to engage with the others in the integration process, at least to a degree, because of the sheer gravity of it.
Yeah, and it seems to me that the role in some ways the role of the Pacific Alliance is to as allies of the United States in particular, to very much consciously serve as a counterbalance within the Latin American Caribbean integration process to the socialist-inspired aspirations of Venezuela and Cuba,
mm-hmm,
and Nicaragua, and one can see that It's interesting the way that the opposition to that and the pressure that's put on the progressive aspirations operate at different levels. So you have at a very high political level, you have this combination of Mexico, Peru, Colombia, and Chile working, and it's also at a very deep economic level. But also out on the streets in Venezuela, for example, the natural allies of the political leadership of the Pacific Alliance countries are putting tremendous direct pressure, even though they're a minority, on the respective governments. And you can see that happening in Ecuador, for example, as well.
Right.
And what's happened in Ecuador is that President Rafael Correa and his government colleagues attempted to modify. And if you look at the legislation, it's a really very modest modification. It's not a, it's not revolutionary by any means.
It's an estate tax, basically, right?
Yeah, it's an inheritance tax. Essentially, it's an inheritance tax, but that has already existed. And all they're doing is increasing the level of the top band of taxation by some, I've forgotten what it is, like 7 or 8%, something like that.
Right.
And one of the provisions was that, for example, if you're a family business and the family, the head of the family dies, who's also the, in Latin America, this is very typical, they're also the head of the business.
Right.
Then what happens to, what is the tax implication of that?
Right.
For the family that inherit the business. And that was an issue that there was a lot of protest about in Ecuador, and the government withdrew the legislation pending a redrafting of the provisions in respect specifically of the inheritance of family businesses.
You know, without knowing well the demographics, just conceptually, you'd have to watch where you set that, because what you can create is a unity of interest between the upper class and the middle class over that issue.
Right.
And the, probably, as far as the middle class goes, the most productive parts of the middle class, which is something you don't want to do.
Right. And that, you know, exactly. So, and that's what, that's the key issue that the government withdrew the legislation on, in pending redrafting it to take into account people's concerns and what seem to be legitimate concerns, you know. Because if you inherit a going business and then suddenly find that you're whacked with a big tax bill, or a relatively big tax bill, that can have impacts on the employees of the company, and with all the knock-on effects that would have, you know. So but the opposition have interpreted that as a moment of weakness.
Yeah. Well, what they're doing though is they're actually organizing they're mobilizing the constituency for it.
Right, and I think over the last week there have been situations somewhat similar to the violence that has dogged Nicaragua dogged Venezuela since the elections following the death of Comandante Eterno Hugo Chavez. Venezuela's opposition have been very uninhibited about deploying violence to get out in the streets to get what they want.
Right.
So far without success. And now it seems that Ecuador, the opposition in Ecuador, are taking a leaf out of the Venezuelan opposition playbook and doing the same, because a few days ago they attacked a police line that was separating them from the opposition, separating the opposition demonstration from a demonstration in support of the government, and they attacked police officers, and 4 police officers were injured. So, and what Rafael Correa is saying to the opposition there is the same as Nicolas Maduro is saying in Venezuela: if you want to overthrow the government, well, we've got elections coming up soon.
Right, that's all.
So, defeat us electorally, but don't try and carry out a violent coup d'etat.
Right. So, and there's so many contradictions there, too, you know. It's
I think the elections are in 2017 in Ecuador.
Yeah, I think you're right.
And in Venezuela, they have the legislative elections at the end of the year, and one very important thing that happened in Venezuela over the last couple of weeks were the primary elections for the governing Socialist Party of the United Socialist Party of Venezuela, and they mobilized just for those primaries. They mobilized 3 million people.
Yeah.
Which is in very, very marked contrast to the primaries that were organized by the opposition that were effectively a complete washout. So there's all the signs are that the PSUV is going to do very well in the legislative elections. And I haven't seen any opinion polls, but what the right-wing press in Venezuela and what their allies in the international media are doing is focusing on completely biased opinion polls that indicate the strong possibility of major gains for the opposition in the legislature, and to the point of them getting a majority.
Right.
But the other polls that aren't projected by the right-wing media state the opposite. So,
yeah.
And the primary election process over the last month or so seems to give the more credibility to the elections, to the opinion polls,
for sure,
that indicate a victory for the government. So,
by like two orders of magnitude, almost.
Yeah.
It's a big difference. You know, also, the same game is being played around the referendum for Sunday in Greece, because up until yesterday, all of the polls indicated a strong no vote, which is what the government's
right.
asking for. And then suddenly yesterday some poll comes out and says it's, like 47 yes to 43 no or something. And with a margin of error, you wouldn't state that the yes is ahead because you're missing. But
for us here in Nicaragua and people who of our political beliefs in Latin America generally, it is fascinating to see how the same pattern of destabilization is being applied to Greece.
Mm-hmm.
That has been applied throughout Nicaragua in Greece's case. So what you get is the right-wing media and the center-right media across Europe, which is most of the corporate,
right.
overwhelmingly the corporate
right.
media,
sure.
are putting out these messages about Greece. Oh, well, the yes vote has gained. They're neck and neck.
Right.
Oh, look at that constitutional the procedure questioning the legality of the referendum, what's going
right.
to happen about that, you know.
Right.
And you just, it's all so clearly manipulated, isn't it? By,
yep.
in this case, by the European Union authorities. But, and it's just an absolute copy, carbon copy, if you like, of what the United States and its allies and its regional and local allies have been doing here in Latin America for decades.
That's right. I mean, look, I can see it coming. The polls, those polls are going to show a yes vote by, you know, a substantial margin, say maybe 53 to 42 or something, and with undecideds, as if there's anyone undecided in Greece. And then it'll come back with an accurate vote, no vote, and then the legitimacy of that vote will be challenged, and there'll be a move on the presidential palace or the prime minister's residence or whatever by the mob that the right wing and the pseudo left have organized, and of course
Greece has a very a history very similar to Latin America in terms of the influence of the military.
Yep.
And people forget that Greece was under a military dictatorship for how many years? 5 years?
Long time.
And it was a substantial time, very much along the lines of what happened in Chile, around the same time.
And that's all the news we have for you right now. For Community Public Radio, I'm Don DeBar in New York. Thanks for listening.